privileged audience to be here and, you know, reconnect. So again, I'm very humbled to know that yes, I have been working on refugees for quite some time. It was my PhD work, although I did work on Bangladesh, Sri Lanka and India, but the groups were different and I was talking about refugees. So this is a slightly different dimension, though I see a continuity, dimension different in relation to the different cases, the Tibetans and the Rohingyas, and of course the countries are India and Bangladesh still. So I am venturing into a domain called statelessness, which we often have ideas about. We, you know, it's just not theoretical, it's something that, you know, it's a state of being, we're existent. But I'll try to put it in a perspective at least where we can find some kind of theoretical relevance to the cases as well as the subject of statelessness. And I will try to juxtapose just not only the cases but and see whether there's some kind of, you know, explanation as to why this is persistent within South Asia. So just pardon me if I'm going to read because I just got in last night, so I'll try not to read too fast, but yeah. Statelessness is a highly complex legal and often critical issue. It has serious humanitarian implications for those it affects, including no legal protection or right to participate in political process, poor employment prospects and poverty, little opportunity to own property, travel restrictions, social exclusion, sexual and political violence, and inadequate access to healthcare and education. This is actually Maureen Lynch's, you know, one of the quotations which I found very interesting. It kind of defines what is statelessness. And of course, statelessness, if we regard as, you know, it's a being, it's a continuous, it's a condition, then we need to put it in relation to the realm of international law and then perhaps connect it to the law of the state, which is domestic law, both in India as well as perhaps in Bangladesh. So in accordance to Article 15 of the Universal Declaration, everyone has the right to nationality. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his nationality. And just to mention a few, 1954 Convention relating to the status of statelessness persons and the 1961 Convention have certain provisions relating to statelessness. So these laws stipulate, however, despite what is statelessness, they kind of lead to the question of what the idea of domestic state. So it's essentially within the laws of domestic state or the domestic laws tend to operate or tend to define who is a stateless person. Right? So in other words, you have a nation state and then you have the international law. But international law is basically suggesting that yes, these laws exist, but it's with the nation state, with the domestic laws that these people have to maneuver. So statelessness determines a relationship between individual and the state. The denial of the link between individual, community and state leads to this existence of statelessness. There is an important, you know, connection between, however, refugees and statelessness, and often has been regarded that one leads to the other. And this I'm quoting is an Executive Committee Conclusion Number 50 within the domain of UNHCR. So in my understanding, a discussion on statelessness needs to be in conjunction with the refugees also. So in this paper or in the presentation, I will address the issue of statelessness of two communities, the Tibetans and the Rohingyas in India and Bangladesh. I specifically address some of the inadequacies within a theoretical framework. So my theoretical framework that I'm using is state and the nature of state formation leading to citizenship laws, which leads to certain degree of statelessness. So I seek to explain why states in South Asia appear to be so unsympathetic towards alien population while assessing condition of the two groups, the Rohingyas and the Tibetans. In comparative perspective, these groups offer an interesting contrast, which further helps us understand the motivation of state, be it the Bangladesh state or the Indian state, in either accepting, denying rights to these groups of, you know, people. Now what is perhaps just to spark a bit of a discussion is interesting is there's a contrast. The statelessness of the Tibetan is different than that of the Rohingyas. And we hopefully in the discussion we can get to a point where we can understand or, you know, have some kind of discussion as to why is such the case. So I have kind of divided my presentation in a roughly three sections. In the first I just give a very brief historical context, and the second I put in the theoretical framework, and third explain a bit of a variation and just touch on some of the variation that exists between the two groups. Now, just a bit of a history, and I'm sure most of you are probably aware of already, but the Rohingyas are the native to the northern Arakan region of Burma, which borders Bangladesh. The name Rohingya originates from the name Rohan or Rohan given to the Arakan people during the 9th and the 10th century. Another group, Rakhine people, reside in the same area of Burma, but they are the ethnic majority, with a Hindu and a Mughal background. Now, with World War II, Rohingyas have suffered a side of, you know, history of abuse and fought for special recognition as an ethnic group. So historically, the first exodus took place after a military coup in 1962, when the new government in Burma at that point in time tried to restrict some of the basic human rights of these groups. In the mid-70s, Burma initiated the Emergency Immigration Act, requiring citizens to possess a certificate, which is called the National Registration Certificate, but according the Rohingyas, the status of foreigners. Now, having this particular status meant that they could not, you know, ask for employment. So there was some kind of inequality. There was the status was not very equal along with others. Now, in 1977, the Rohingyas experienced a much greater obstacle under the different government, which is the Dragon King at that point in time. And we find there's a gradual, you know, movement of population across the border. Now, this is what I have been able to learn so far, was that 1978 perhaps was the first a large group of refugees entered Bangladesh. But most of these apparently were returned or they were repatriated in 1979. So the exodus that I am concerned with is the one of 1991 and 1992. Now, this is important simply because that was a time when militarization happened, or, you know, the State Law and Order Restoration Council, often called as SLORC, assumed power at that point in time. And the Burmese policy towards Rohingyas, of course, changed drastically. And such was the case that the citizenship law distinguished that a person could have or assume nationality had to be of Burmese ancestry originating back to 1823, which was one of the, you know, landmark in order to acquire that status of citizenship. Now, however, most of these Rohingyas, of course, for some very obvious reason, found it difficult to acquire, you know, show some kind of papers and things like that. So, however, what we see is there's an exodus from 1991 to 1992, and most of these Burmese Muslim refugees took refuge in Cox's Bazar area within Bangladesh. All right. Now, at that point in time, of course, one has to keep in mind that they were a minority back then. But what we have to also bear in mind that Bangladesh has an affinity because it happens to be a predominantly Muslim-dominated population. And one would presume that they would have a better status, perhaps, or they would be welcomed at that point in time. Now, what we find interesting is soon after that, there was an issue of, you know, repatriation that assumed in 1992. So in other words, the government, the Bangladesh government at that point in time, refused to, you know, shoulder the burden completely. And as a result, there were repatriations. Some, you know, the UNHCR alleged there was forcible repatriation. It wasn't voluntary, it was rather involuntary repatriation. So it was scheduled to end in 1995, but for a lot of unrest that was going on within the Burmese, you know, side, it seemed difficult to completely repatriate. So what I'm concerned with is a group that is obviously there in Cox's Bazar at this point, and they're kind of refugees, but they're stateless. So that's why I have kept it, you know, like, you know, open-ended, and I'm, you know, open for discussion, and I'm looking forward to it, you know, whether they're indeed refugee, what is the definition of a refugee, what is the definition of statelessness, and whether they actually, you know, connect. In my understanding, they do, but I'm interested in, you know, unraveling that puzzle a bit. And this is a bit of a blurb I got from, you know, the Human Rights Watch, because, you know, I'm still, I'm looking forward to some of my field work in Cox's Bazar while I'm there in Bangladesh. Now, some of these, of course, they, you know, they've been there for a long period now, so they're not treated very well. The ration condition is poor, mobility, hygiene, just to name a few. And, you know, they're still in camps, so-called camps, but not the camps that we often see in pictures or things like that. So, apparently, there are about 21 to about 30,000 Rohingya, you know, Burmese, who are now being called internally displaced in Cox's Bazar area. All right. Now that's the case of the Rohingya. Now the Tibetans, just to put, like, you know, just very quickly, they entered, the Tibetan refugees entered in the 50s, 60s, and so on and so forth. Now what we find striking about this particular case is, at the very early stage, the Tibetan refugees were able to gain recognition. And that recognition is a political recognition, a recognition that allows them to be part and parcel of the Indian society while retaining their exclusive culture, which is the Tibetan culture. Now, I find it interesting simply because this community has been allowed to be part of the informal citizenry. In other words, they can get gainful employment, education, and at the same time, we find that the Indian government is quite open to the idea of, you know, that with the typical culture, which is very peaceful, and if one visits Dharamshala, one gets a sense of, you know, what is going on in that part of the world. So this is just roughly the two cases. Now, connect it back to some of the theories that's existing and why is such is the case. Again, having said that, Indian, one of the successful cases of Tibet, and mind you, there are a lot of unsuccessful cases as well, or not so successful, such as, you know, the Tamils, you know, the refugees, the Chakmas, and the Afghans, the Iranians, just to name few. But I kind of deliberately wanted to, bring into the discussion one of the success cases where we find statelessness with a difference, with something, you know, something else that perhaps is going on. So it is imperative to understand why states in South Asia have been unable to accommodate alien populations, especially given the status of aliens that these groups may enjoy in other countries, such as, you know, the Western countries. We find that the denizen status is given to these communities. Now, some of these communities, not those of South Asian origin, but could be from anywhere in the rest of the world, if they are refugees or migrants or let's say non-citizens, just to put it roughly, they have a different status in back in the West. So my question is, what makes South Asia so unique? Why is it that we find that there's a big obstacle? That's one. Second, if there's something going on here together that we can perhaps connect it to. So I would propose the study of state and state formation and its link with that of, you know, rights determination process. A detailed investigation of state formation will provide some theoretical insight into this puzzle. Studies of state formation allow scholars to determine the relation between power, authority, and structure while developing an understanding on how power, authority, and questions of legitimacy remain unchallenged once the foundation has been laid. Now, just a few scholars, Corrigan here, you know, Chatterjee and Sarmitu versus Madan himself, there's been a lot of literature on, you know, this whole idea of what is a state. Now, just to kind of identify, you know, few such scholars, state has been defined as a cultural form and state formation as cultural revolution, arguing that some identities, new identities that are formed, often go through constant categorization and recreation of everyday routine rituals. So in other words, the idea of state as it is a physical idea. Now, when that physicality is contested by groups of different kinds with different needs, there is a possibility of interaction. There's a possibility of contestation. And as a result, we find that in some countries, that contestation results in some degree of not necessarily just rights, but some degree of protection. So my question is, what is going on, let's say, within India, to begin with? Second, perhaps if time allows, within Bangladesh, if such is not happening. So in other words, state has the opportunity to exert itself as a physical entity through varied policies of either marginalization or in some instances accommodation, depending on the nature of the state formation itself. Now, however, one has to also bear in mind that the post-colonial states in South Asia do have a similar trajectory, but their outcomes are different. Now, if you look at very quickly, India adopted a very multicultural approach at the very, very beginning. Today we call it multicultural, but it was more like, you know, secular, the whole credential of secularism. Bangladesh, we find, is a predominantly started on a secular plan, but it has moved away from, let's say, more towards a dominant culture. Sri Lanka, default, it has accepted the dominant culture. Though they don't call it such, but we find through the policies of different government, there is an emphasis on a Sinhala-oriented, you know, policies, motivations, so on and so forth. So, the statecraft carefully selected areas of negotiation, allowing opportunities for policies to evolve. Now, in India, the multicultural and the pluralist tendencies were upheld and were carefully reflected in some of the policies. Nandi asserts that the Indian state has predominantly three stages. First, state as a protector, state as a modernizer, liberator, and state as an arbitrator. So, we find that most literature on state would probably follow the same lines, asserting that, you know, the official ideology is that of pan-Indian nationalism, based on territorial integrity and secularism with federalism and so on and so forth. So while we find that Indian state accepts diverse demands based on religious. It allowed states to be created on the basis of linguistic lines. We find groups that are existing outside the domain, which, you know, they really don't have, or they can't challenge the state in any way. So in other words, they don't find a foothold in this entire mechanism of statehood that exists. Now, typically, state by itself discussion is not going to be enough. So just to link it with the degree of, let's say, citizenship. So typically, state also constructed citizenship as, you know, determined by state policy. A sense of belonging, identity, and nationality seem to be tied to a particular territory that legitimizes status, rights, and entitlement of people belonging to it. So what exactly is this idea of rights that is only linked to citizenship? Now, citizenship has been often defined as, you know, within quotes, fixed and non-negotiable rights and obligation as embodied in written constitution. Now, states in society, especially South Asian societies, we find accepted citizenship rights as a political recognition, as a political tool. Okay? And as a result, it was a status, a legal status. Now, let's look into one particular case that I'm not going to look at for this presentation, the Chakmas, who entered India in 1968, and they are in some parts of Arunachal Pradesh. Now, technically, this group of people entered prior to the formation of East Pakistan, which later became Bangladesh, so to speak. So there was a negotiation by the government at that point in time, by Indira Gandhi and Mujib, that accepted that what will happen to this group of people who entered in 1968. So technically they are stateless. They're not refugees, they're not stateless, but then what is stateless? The Indian government doesn't define what is stateless. It does not define who is a refugee. It just says they're foreigners. So foreigners is a blank category that encompasses everybody and nobody. So we find that this group of people, there was a memorandum of understanding. As a result, it was kind of accepted that the Indian government will provide them default citizenship. Of course, I think Anusha will have a lot more to say later on, saying, you know, that they're not really, they're far from it. They're not even, they don't enjoy any kind of status of citizenship. Citizen is a person who can acquire property, who can vote. Yes, some groups can vote here, but probably they cannot, you know, acquire property. There are restrictions on mobility, if I'm not mistaken. And also, of course, marriage. How do you prove that you're married to somebody of Indian origin? If you have children, you get to, you know, you have to enroll them to school. So there are certain practical issues that we often overlook. Now, to come back to, let's say, some of the other cases that we have, like there are the Biharis in Bangladesh itself. They often call, you know, the stranded Biharis. They are technically not in camps, but they are like in kind of a house, and that camp has been transformed into a house, basically, and in a Mirpur area. And this again was it's an ongoing negotiation between Pakistan and Bangladesh right now. So that is one category of statelessness. Then, of course, you have, you know, the estate Tamil case, which is one of, again, success case where Indian government and the Sri Lankan government was able to negotiate the idea of what is citizenship. Now, what has all this got to do with my cases? My cases are kind of an extension of such some of the cases that have been going on for such a long time. The Rohingyas are little, you know, very few opportunity exists for them. They are refugee/stateless people. Tibetan, yes, they are refugees, but not everybody accepts them as stateless because they have states. They have a status. Of course, stateless in the sense some of them would like to go back to liberated Tibet, independent Tibet. But until that happens, are they really stateless in India? Because they enjoy some of the status of citizenship. So the question is, why is it that South Asian state, or let's say India, has such a discriminatory attitude? One of the official line that often being put forward is these groups of people enjoy rights. They have status. Why? Because the constitution has essentially allowed them certain provisions, you know, right to religion, right to creed, movement, and so on and so forth. Article 21, just to name a few, Article 14 and Article 25, that basically asserts that if an individual is faced with any kind of grievances, any kind of, you know, issues of, let's say, encroachment of some of the basic human fundamental rights, can approach the court. Now, it's obviously most of us who have worked on refugee stateless people know how many would actually go to the judiciary for redressal. A, they would probably know, but wouldn't know, and B, they would probably think they would get, you know, identified. So the idea that the judicial protection in India exists in some form, but how far it can be availed is another question. But of course, having said that, one has to also very quickly mention this one particular landmark decision that was given by the in a case of the the state of Arunachal Pradesh and Khudiram Chakma case. Now this particular case stands out in itself, and again I'm a bit pessimistic and slightly with a little bit of optimism, because this is the only case where we find a refugee slash stateless people approach the court and was able to get back some of his dignity. Now of course this is the only decision so far, which essentially allowed this individual that with the decision that, you know, the judiciary suggested that no one shall be deprived of his life, his or her life and liberty without due process of law. So we find often the argument that Indian judiciary is playing a constructive role. Now the question is, if it indeed playing a very constructive role, perhaps it needs to abolish this ad hocism that exists and, you know, make it a little more concrete. That's one. Secondly, we find, I mean, this, you know, this liberal interpretation is only restrictive. It depends, you know, which official you're leading to, and again there's the mechanism of thought. So the determination of the refugee determination process is problematic. There is no such process to begin with. So we find that they first arrested, then they're housed as like common criminals, and then we find they are basically treated till they get, you know, the protection of the UNHCR. The role of UNHCR is something that we need to probably also bring into a discussion. UNHCR has officially no role to play, because again it's a very problematic zone. It is a body that can assist and protect non-citizens, refugees, aliens, you know, those who don't have any kind of rights. But the Indian government, time to time, has always stepped in, suggesting whenever they have kind of, let's say, gone over the bounds of boundaries of their jurisdiction. So as a result, we find that even UNHCR, with its mandate, is unable to do perhaps as much as it would probably like. And this is again based on some of the discussions I've had in the past, that yes, they would probably like to, but they want to keep the Indian government happy so that they are not completely sent away. Like for instance, another case I would like to bring into one of the cases I did was the Chakma refugees. When the Chakma refugees were repatriated, UNHCR wasn't even involved. It was entirely a bilaterally conducted repatriation, and this is the Chakma refugees who came in the 80s and who have been successfully, so-called successfully repatriated to Khagarachedi and others in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. It was done between the government of India and government of Bangladesh. So there was no way of finding out what exactly is going on and why, and you know, whether indeed it is voluntary slash involuntary. So just to very quickly, you know, give you the contrast in relation to the, you know, the two cases, the Rohingyas and the Tibetans. Now the Rohingyas, we find, of course, they're in a very abysmal state. You know, they're refugees slash IDPs with little chances of ever returning. But at the same time, this is a group that have no other place to go. Earlier they did have some degree of, you know, freedom of mobility, and they did enjoy some, you know, equality because of being, you know, having the same faith. But of late what has happened is, because of their prolonged stay, what has happened is adversely affected that. So we find the Rohingya cases like adversely affected, you know, domain. Then we have the Tibetans, of course, for whatever reason, perhaps more political than social, we find that Tibetan group is one of the groups that enjoying some sort of good status in India. And that's where I'm going to leave it, and then, you know, we can probably, you know, bring into a discussion, have some discussion.
Thank you. I think you would all agree that this was a very good and fascinating discussion. And